Hello and shalom. Welcome to this episode of Image Bearers Radio. I'm your host, Joe Amon. We got a great show ahead, so buckle up and hang on. Here we go. Well, shalom, shalom. Welcome to this episode of Image Bearers Radio. I am your host, Joe Amon, coming to you all the way from Southwest Louisiana. I hope you are doing incredibly well. If you are checking us out on Hebrew Nation Online, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Sunday, just want to say thanks for tuning in and thanks for sticking around and listening. If you missed it on the radio, then you are probably listening either on Hebrew Nation Online in the archives or at our website, outofashesministries.org. Or on our free mobile app, or possibly even on iTunes. A lot of places that we're trying to get to you guys and gals, so hopefully you're checking us out on one of those platforms. So if it's your first time listening, just let me say a quick welcome and thanks so much for tuning in or for checking out our show. Maybe it was recommended to you by someone or you just stumbled across it. Either way, I hope you enjoy your time with us. I would encourage you to go back and listen to some of the past shows because we've covered a pretty good bit of ground here. And so it would be beneficial to go back and kind of get caught up and get refreshed on some of the other conversation. So many of you are regular listeners, and I just want to as I do every week, I think it's really important to thank you guys and to just share my appreciation and let you know that you are not taken for granted. I appreciate all the comments and questions and support and the conversation that is had around these podcasts. Last thing is just if you are looking for a Sabbath fellowship, maybe you just don't have fellowship in your area, or maybe you have fellowship but they meet at a different time, I'd love to invite you to jump in and join us for our Sabbath services, 10 a.m. Central every Shabbat. We live stream to our website. Again, that's outofashesministries.org/live. You can catch us there. We also simulcast to Facebook and to YouTube. And so jump in the comments, tell us Shabbat Shalom, tell us where you're joining in from. We love to hear from you guys. Get involved in the comments. We have a great active comment section. People are always talking and chit-chatting back and forth, and that's an awesome thing. So 10 a.m. Central, every Shabbat, we would love to have you join us. All right, so all the housekeeping out of the way. I want to jump into this week's episode, but before we just have a moment of prayer, we are going to do some review from last week, catch up, tie up a couple things, and then we're going to jump into this week's topic, which is the first topic, the first group that we are going to cover. We talked last week about the five Jewish responses to Hellenism. And so we're going to review a little bit of that, and then we're going to jump into our first group, the Sadducees. Avinu Malkinu, our Father and our King, we are so thankful that we get to come together and talk about your word, talk about you. Father, I pray that your character would rest in us, your spirit would rest in us, that we may represent you well in the world that you gave us. All right, so let's jump in and do some quick review, and then we will get into our topic for today. So we have been in this section called the Silent Years the last couple of weeks, this section of time where, I don't know about you, but for me growing up, these Silent Years, this 400-some-odd years where basically God was silent, there were no prophetic voices that we have recorded, and it just seemed for me as a kid growing up, and even into high school and college, it seemed to me like there was just a dead spot in history. And up until the last couple of years when I really, and really the last year or so, when I really started studying this intertestamental period, It's been that long that I realized that, holy smokes, it is not quiet at all. These 400 years or so are anything but silent. And when, of course, I hope you know that when we're talking about the intertestamental period, we're talking about in our English Bibles, we're talking between Malachi and Matthew. And in the Hebrew Bibles, we're talking about Second Chronicles, between Second Chronicles and Matthew. And so a lot of stuff going on in this intertestamental period. And so 586 B.C., we have the Babylonian captivity of Judah. And then about 538, the exiles begin to return. And we know that there are several different waves, likely three major waves of return from exile, Babylonian exile. And that starts about 538-ish. You have Ezra one group, Nehemiah one group. You have and you also have a lot of Jews that stayed in Babylon. So that's the reason for things like the Talmud Bavli, right? The Babylonian Talmud and the Talmud Yerushalami, the Jerusalem Talmud. And so 538 is whenever that kind of begins to happen. And then an amazing thing happens or begins to happen in the early 300s BC. A man comes on the scene named Alexander the Great. And we talked about Alexander the Great last week. And he comes in about 332. He actually conquers Israel. And the reason why Alexander the Great and Hellenism, his euangelion, his gospel, the reason why those things are so important to understand is because of the way they radically shaped and changed all the places that were under Greek rule. So that would include the land of Israel, right? The way that they systematically changed the worldview of the conquered people under Alexander, and then later under his generals, the Ptolemies, the Seleucids, etc. And it's important because the world that Yeshua lived in, right, the world that he came into was very internally focused. And I think that's really important to kind of get our heads around. Yeshua's world of Judaism is very internally focused. Remember week before last, we asked the question, you know, how did we get here, exile? How did we get here as far as, okay, we came back to the land, we're back home, but it's not quite home. It doesn't feel like it. It's not like the kingdom was under David HaMelech, under King David. And so the way that Judaism had to change and evolve in order to cope with this Hellenistic ideology, it was a huge part of the conversation in the first century. And so Yeshua, a lot of the things that he says is going to actually touch on that. And a lot of the interactions that we see him have are going to be in that framed by that Hellenistic, overtake of culture. So, we talked about synagogue 2 weeks ago, and particularly the begin of synagogue, the evolution of synagogue, what it means. Remember, super, super, super duper important that synagogue does not replace Beit HaMikdash. Synagogue does not replace temple. That's so important to remember, right? But synagogue is community. It is kind of where your community life revolves around. We spent some time talking about the education system in the first century. And if you remember the three phases of education, Bet Sefer, which is house of the book, Bet Talmud, which is house of learning, and Beit Midrash, which is house of study. And so these different phases of schooling that these young Jewish boys would go through, and only the best of the best made it to the next phase. And so we spent an episode talking about that. That is absolutely one of my favorite teachings to do. It's one of my favorite episodes to do because I just think it brings so much life to first century Judaism, to the disciples, to Yeshua himself. It just impacts so many areas of that time period. I think it's really, really, really important. And so last week we talked about Hellenism. Welcome to Hellenism. You may have heard the term Hellenism before. You may have, heard of Hellenistic Jews, or maybe it's something that you studied in school way back when, if you can remember. But Hellenism comes on the scene by way of Alexander the Great, and it is his euangelion. And so euangelion means gospel, and we'll do a whole couple of shows on gospel, but the idea of gospel is not something that is new to our New Testament writers. So the idea, the usage, and the idea of euangelion In the Hebrew, it's basar, or the besara, is not something that's new, and it wasn't created by New Testament authors. The term euangelion and the idea of good news or good tidings goes back several centuries, and it is kind of systematized by Alexander the Great, a genius leader and military leader who really is the one who commercializes the idea and who really propagates the idea of euangelion with the outlook of Hellenism. And we quoted Protagoras, which is a Greek philosopher, as saying that of all things, man is the measure, right? Man is the measure of all things. Man is the center. And so we talked about how, you know, the Greek gods are super powerful, and you don't get rid of them. You don't do away with the gods because they're so entwined in your culture. They're super powerful, but they're really stupid, and they're really, you know, they're fickle, and they're emotional, and they're rash, and different things. However, mankind, not all powerful, but really intelligent. As a matter of fact, smarter than the gods, more sensible, more rational than the gods. And so you have coming up this demigod idea, which is what we see like in Hercules, you know, some of those stories that we know so well, right? And so the idea is that the gods have to be, can be improved by relations and offspring with humans because man is the center of it all. And so, if we just think about our culture today and we think about, you know, is it Burger King, maybe that's your way right away. Make mornings about you. You know, you hear all, listen to the commercials, listen to advertisements, listen to propaganda, if you will, that's out in the commercials. And you're going to hear this. We are very much Hellenistic. We believe it really is, life does really revolve around us. And so, you know, Alexander, part of his Hellenistic or maybe the foundation of his Hellenistic conquering and the way that he conquered everything was that it's massively expensive to have an army stationed everywhere that you've conquered, especially pull up a map of Alexander the Great's empire and you see how vast it is. It is massive. And so, you know, Greece can't afford to stage armies in all of these places. So Alexander, in his brilliance, said, well, you know what? We don't need an army everywhere. If we can develop four pillars, if you can give me four things and we can develop and we can have control over these four things as the empire of Greece, then we can rule the whole world and keep it under our submission. And so we said those four things were education, healthcare, entertainment, and athletics, right? Education, healthcare, entertainment, and athletics. And so, you know, how do you conquer the whole world? Well, conquering the whole world might not be a problem, but keeping the whole world conquered may be a problem. You ever get behind, you get busy. Maybe I'm just telling my personal business here, but you ever get busy, work, kids, things, you know, just get busy and the house gets untidy, you know, ends up being, you know, piles of clothes here and there, or, you know, piles of paperwork here and there and different stuff, and stuff just doesn't get picked up off the floor or, you know, whatever. And it just gets untidy, gets messy. Well, it's great to take one day and just like, you know, I mean, you just kill it. Everything gets clean. The floors get cleaned, you know, vacuum mopped, whatever. Everything gets dusted. The walls get, you know, wiped down. Everything. Windows get clean, mirrors, et cetera, clothes gets done, dishes, kitchen, boom. You knock it all out and it takes you a day and it's hard and you're done, but then you're done, right? And so conquering that home, conquering that tidiness is not the big deal. That's one day every so often that you have to really, you know, kick tail to get it done. But what's harder is maintaining it, right? And so you have to have a system in place. You have to have some disciplines. You have to have some things in place, a schedule and responsibilities maybe to different family members, especially if you have kids and all those kinds of things. And so Alexander, for him conquering, he was a military genius. So conquering the vast, political and geographic landscape that he did was not a problem, but keeping it under his influence could have been a challenge. So you do it by these four pillars, and these are the four pillars he developed and really brought to the forefront. And this became the worldview. This became the worldview of so many. So then Alexander dies. we talked about last week. He dies, and Israel is set right in the middle of two of his generals. So Alexander has four main generals, and when he dies, they break his empire up into four different regions. And Israel is right on the border between the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemies in the south. So the Seleucids have Syria, Turkey. The Ptolemies have Egypt and northern Africa. And so Israel is always getting back and forth, back and forth, back and forth between these two generals as they fight for expanding their kingdom. So the Ptolemy families end up being this kind of – their thing was kind of that, you know, well, we're not going to force you by the blade to be Greek. We're just going to make it really hard not to be. So it's going to put Greekness everywhere around you to where you almost can't help it. The Seleucids, on the other hand, were much different, and that's where we come to the Maccabean Revolt. During the Maccabean Revolt, which is 167 BC, Israel is under Seleucid control, right? They are under the Hellenistic Seleucid Greeks. And so the Maccabeans revolt. We know if you celebrate Hanukkah, or at least you know about it, you know what an incredible story, an incredible time that is. And so what happens after the Hasmoneans get control over Israel back in a miraculous way? Well, now that it's kind of like the dog that chases the car, right? Well, what is he going to do with it once he catches it? So the Hasmoneans have this thing where, well, we got power, we got control back. Now what do we do? So in good Jewish form, they go back to the text. And they see that through Leviticus, Numbers, that God intended for the priests to rule and to care for Israel. And so the Hasmoneans were of the line of the priesthood. And so they took over power. They become very corrupt within 100 years, and they love Hellenism. And so they begin to spread Hellenism throughout Israel. And so there are five major kind of reactions to Hellenism. And they are the Sadducees, the Herodians, the Hasidim, which is two subgroups, Pharisees and Zealots, and the Essenes. So Sadducees, Herodians, Pharisees, Zealots, and Essenes. So this week we're going to talk about Sadducees in particular. So the who, what, when, and where of the Sadducees. So one thing that's really important to remember, as we just talked about, is that these Sadducees, where do they come from? Well, we have in Samuel Kings, we have again in, let's say, Ezekiel, they're mentioned, the sons of Zadok, Nehemiah, 1 Chronicles. We have after King David, the priesthood goes to the line of a man named Zadok. He is a priest, a Kohen, and he receives the priestly line, Zadok. If you know anything about Hebrew, Zadok is another word related to another word, or the same word rather, and as the word for righteous in Hebrew, tzaddik, right? The righteous one, the tzaddik, or the righteous ones, tzaddikim. And so Zadok is an anglicized version of the word tzaddik, and that means the righteous, right? So you have this righteous high priest, and his line is given the line of the high priesthood. And so we have the sons of Zadok that come down through, and the Zadokites, they're called in English, the Zadokim in Hebrew, the righteous ones, or the priests, this priestly family. The Hasmoneans, the Maccabees that revolt and take Israel back over from Greece, they are of this line of Zadok. And so they are priests, but they're rural priests. They're kind of on the outskirts of Jerusalem, Modein, which is, you know, outside of Jerusalem, a few miles. They're rural priests. And so they take power and basically give power to the priests, of which they are. And so they kind of become this kingly priestly duality in the life of Israel. And so they, two or three decades, they rule about, well, actually for about 100 years they rule, but it only takes about two or three decades for them to become absolutely corrupt. And what does that mean, corrupt? Well, how did they become corrupt? Well, these Zadokites, these Zadokim, the Hasmoneans, and by the way, we get the word Sadducee from the word Zadokim. Zadokim, Sadducee. It's just the transliteration, you know, and the way that kind of the name evolved. But Sadducee means Zadokim, or Zadokites, from the line of Zadok. And so how did they become corrupt? Well, you have after Greece, right? As Greece is coming, its time is coming to an end. You have what nation that's coming up in power? What nation is rising in power? That's Rome, right? Right, that's Rome. And so there's a lot of interplay and a lot of things that are happening, a lot of shady deals, under the table stuff for the Sadducees, the Zadokites, the Hasmoneans, and those of their dynasty to be able to stay in power and to be able to preserve Israel as its own state. And so what they do is they go to this this man named Herod. And this Herod guy, I tell you what, they go to this guy named Herod. Now, Herod, some scholars, would argue that Herod is Jewish or half Jewish, maybe by his mother, I believe. And yet what we know about Herod is that he is the son of the king of Idumea Nabatea. Idumea Nabatea is basically modern-day Jordan-ish. It is where Petra is and those. So it's modern-day Jordan and the areas around it. We know that if we know our biblical geography and we know our biblical timeline, we also know this area, this geography, just east of Israel, northeast of Israel. We also know this place as Edom. Now, do you remember where Edom comes from or who Edom comes from? It's from Esau, right? Yaakov and Esau. Esau, his land is eventually called Edom, and they are called the Edomites. So there can be some case to be made that maybe Herod was part Jewish or Hebrew or Israelite in some way. But the crazy thing about his king, his dad, they control the spice trade. I think we talked about this a little bit already, but they control the spice trade. It would be like one family, right? It would be like one family in the entire world controlling all of the oil. Now, they may not own all of the oil. Herod and his family didn't own all the spices, but where they're located, this crossroads, they control the flow of the spice trade. And so we have today like OPEC, right? Which I'm not going to get political, but we know about OPEC, and they basically control the flow and the pricing and et cetera, of oil in our nation. But that's a group of countries. Imagine one family, one guy and his son, basically, that are controlling all of this. The wealth that Herod acquired and that he had, historians, and this may be blowing things out of proportion a little bit, but basically the way historians talk about it is that King Solomon would have mowed Herod's grass. He was that wealthy. So what you have is you have in the Sadducean families, you have this arising of seven different families. And these seven families, they become the chief priests. So if you're familiar with that term from the Gospels, the chief priests, these are these seven specific families of the Hasmonean dynasty, of those that are left over from the Maccabees, right? And they are very wealthy, extremely wealthy, upper crust, very opulent lifestyles. You know, they live very, very, very well off. They're not hurting for anything. And they are the temple leadership, right? They're the ones that control the temple leadership in Israel. So these seven families, they get together and they figure out, well, there's Rome coming on the horizon. And so what are we going to do about Rome? How do we stay in power? And then how do we preserve Israel as a nation? What do we do about Rome? We can't fight them militarily because they're a juggernaut. And so these Sadducees being very savvy, these seven families being very savvy, they come up with a plan to be able to partner with different political entities in order to preserve their station and their nation. And so after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about Herod the Great. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to the second segment in this episode of Image Bearers Radio. So we have the Sadducees that are struggling to keep power and preserve power. They control the temple, which if you control the temple, first of all, why do they control the temple? Because they're of the priestly line, the high priestly line of Zadok, right, of Zadik. And why do they control the temple? And if you control the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, the house, then you basically control all of Israelite life, because all of Israelite life revolves around Beit HaMikdash, revolves around the Holy Temple. And so they're extremely powerful, right? But extremely corrupt as well. And so what they do, seeing Rome on the horizon, is that they go to, in some ways, their cousin, I guess, Herod, and they invite him to marry one of the Hasmonean princesses. And thereby, so if you believe Herod was not Jewish whatsoever, then he becomes Jewish by marrying into the Hasmonean family, okay? He brings all of his wealth. So Rome has a juggernaut of power. They are militaristically like nothing the world has ever seen. But they are struggling in the wealth department, and history would tell us this as well. So the Sadducees, in a really cunning, like really savvy way, they bring in Herod, and he has all the wealth. And Herod goes to Caesar and says, "Hey, we can do this thing. You know, we can be buddies. We can be pals, and I'll take care of Israel, and we'll do all the." And Caesar goes, "Great, sounds like a great deal." And so the Sadducees basically negotiate this deal where they get to stay in power under this kind of puppet king Herod. And so then you have all of this Hellenistic influence that's coming in through the Sadducees. Okay, and so we have something really important to remember, is that Sadducees are priests. Okay, we're gonna refer back to this a lot. Just you have to remember this: Sadducees are priests. Okay, and thereby they control the temple. Right, they are responsible for preserving the temple. But not all priests are Sadducees. So it's kind of like the fingers and thumbs thing. All Sadducees are priests, but not all priests are Sadducees. These Sadducees are so corrupt, they love Hellenism. They love, they love Hellenistic art. They love the mythology, the Greek mythology. They love, they love the athletics and the sports. I can't remember where I heard this, but there's some quote, that maybe it's Josephus. I believe it is. I believe it's Josephus that makes the statement, and forgive me, I can't think of where it is, but Josephus makes the statement that there came a time in the temple that there were not enough priests to run Shabbat services because they were all down watching the naked mud wrestling, right? So there are these priests that they're given the responsibility through the line of Zadok. They are given the responsibility of preserving. Do you remember all the way back in our Genesis study, all the way back when we talked about Gan Eden and Adam and Chava? You remember what the charge that Hashem gave to Adam was? Avod v'shamar, right? Was to serve and protect, guard, keep sacred space, which is also what Aaron and his line were told. You're going to guard and keep my tabernacle, my sacred space. So these Zadokites, Zadokim, Sadducees, that is their responsibility. That is their lineage, to guard and protect the temple. And yet due to their corruption, the temple absolutely becomes a place, you know, that's just full of Hellenistic corruption. The Sadducees become this like religious mafia, literally. And every mafia has a hit squad, right? They have the heavies, right? They're going to go to take care of business. Well, the Sadducees also have a hit squad. They have their own set of heavies known as the Temple Guard. Now, if you've read through the Gospels and you see the Temple Guard, you probably, like me, you know, you thought, well, these are just good Jews, you know, just good Jewish priests that are doing their best to serve Levitical priests, they're doing their best to serve, the temple and to do, but most of the temple guards are actually, they're under the employment of these Sadducees. And the temple guard are priests. They're not non-priests. They are priests. And so they're Sadducees as well in the sense of, they may not be from the line of Zadok, but they are in alignment with the worldview of those seven families. And so the term Sadducee originally is for that seven family or that line, that priestly line of Zadok. That's what Sadducee really like narrowly refers to. And yet as time progresses, the term begins to generalize a little bit, and it's any priest that aligns with the Sadducean kind of way of seeing things, that high priestly way of seeing things. But not all priests are buying into this thing. Not all priests agree with the Sadducean way of kind of moving and shaking and, the way they live their lives. We hear about one in the Gospels, right? You remember who that is? That is Zechariah, right? Zechariah and Elisheva. John the Baptist, Yohanan HaMagbil's father. He is a righteous priest. Now, just think about this for a minute. He is, the Bible calls he and Elisheva righteous and upright in all their ways before Hashem. I mean, that inscription is unbelievable. Just, hopefully we're past the thing where we're like, oh, nobody's perfect. Well, it's not about being perfect. It's about living upright, being faithful, being of loyalty. And I'm sorry if you don't agree with being perfect or not. That's not the conversation. But the Gospels tell us that Zechariah and Elisheva were upright in all their ways. That is monumental. We don't understand how huge that is, especially in light of the environment and the context and the culture of the temple. So Zechariah is serving in the temple. He's exposed to all this Sadducean stuff. He's exposed to all this Hellenistic stuff. There's probably a lot of pressure there, right? And yet he reserves himself. He protects and guards himself from those things. I mean, just a dynamic and incredible man that Zechariah and woman that Elisheva are. They're just seeing them in this context should bring some more honor to Zechariah and Elisheva. And so, you have all this corruption that's happening. So there's a website you should check out called the Wohl Museum, W-O-H-L, the Wohl Museum, located in Jerusalem. And there they have a model of what archaeologists have discovered or uncovered as a priestly home. And this thing is absolutely massive. It's nuts. It's something like 17, 18 bedrooms. Over 20 mikvaot, or ritual cleansing baths, immersion, and it actually has several tiers because of course it's built on a hillside, but it also crosses over one of the roads going up to the temple. Like it's unbelievable how intricate and how detailed and how beautiful it is. And so I would encourage you to go on the website and look at it, how big. There's a lot of speculation, and a lot of people will agree that this is probably the house of the high priestly family, of their family. This is probably their quarter because it's on the top of this knoll, this little hill up near the temple. And so it's probably, if the high priest is probably going to live on the top in the best house. It's almost, it's palace almost. And so there's very good, reason to maybe believe that this is the house where Yeshua was brought before his crucifixion, and maybe have stood in one of these very courtrooms that are being unearthed by really gifted archaeologists. So it's really, I would invite you to go to look at it. And what's interesting about it is that you have these Sadducees that are so corrupt. You're gonna spend Shabbat, or you're gonna spend Friday before Shabbat watching, violent sports, athletics, theater, where they're doing, pan mythology, and they're doing Greek mythology, and you have all this stuff. You're gonna spend all of that time in that society, in that culture, and yet this house has over 20, I think it's 21, has 21 mikvaot. So what is that? Like, just think about that for a minute. So the Sadducees have not rejected their Judaism. That's what's important to see here. They may have been corrupt, but they have not rejected their Judaism. They actually, if anything, they wear their Judaism loud and proud, right? They almost overdo their Judaism in a sense. It's not that they've rejected it, but they feel like they can do both at the same time. They want to be able to do both at the same time, and they actually pull it off in some ways. And so it's given this sanctimonious role, this holy role of protecting and guarding God's sacred space, and yet through Hellenistic thought and through these political deals that are made and all this kind of stuff, we have this idea of in our American political system these days of the swamp, right? Well, you can imagine this is the swamp. And so you have these mikvaot, these ritual baths, because they know that in order to serve in the temple, you have to be ritually clean. And so they may spend a whole day watching naked mud wrestling and watching, you know, Greeks die in sport and bloodshed and who knows whatever else. But before it comes time to serve their post in the temple, they are going to go and they're going to ritually wash. You see how they in themselves have done what a lot of us do, and I'm just going to kind of get messy a little bit, but we justify our attachment, our closeness, our involvement with things of the world, quote unquote, or the culture around us, but we still want to do our duty to Hashem. We still want to do our duty to the things of God, and yet we just really want to enjoy having this other stuff, right? And so we're going to get to some application in one show. We're going to spend a whole show kind of on application. So I don't want to get too deep into it now, but I want you to start kind of thinking about which one of these groups are you. We're going to go through all five responses, and I want you to think about which group am I? Am I Sadducean? Well, I mean, we're not priests, so I mean, in the technical sense, as being from the bloodline of the high priest. But, you know, the New Testament talks about us being priests. And so in that sense, we can kind of relate. We all have a service to do, right? We all have a job to do for Hashem. We all have a calling. And so in that sense, we can kind of think, like, how Sadducean are we? And so they have these, you know, you see them portrayed in movies, and we have illustrations and stuff where you see these, you know, these Sadducean priests that are just loaded down in this gold and garb, and it's just really loud. You know, I think of Passion of the Christ comes to mind, like when you see Caiaphas, right, and you see all the gold and just the gaudiness, and they're so uppity and they're so arrogant, right, about their priestly duty. But what I never knew, and now what hopefully you know, is that behind all of that showiness, there is just muck and filth and this entanglement and this embeddedness with these other ideologies and other worldviews and other systems. And so these Sadducees that were supposed to be not only the protectors of sacred space, but they are supposed to preserve the ideology that Hashem is the center. He is the source. He's the cloud and the pillar of fire, right? He's the deliverer. He is the one source where all things come from. They are supposed to protect that idea and show Israel not only to protect the sacred space, but to teach Israel how to love Hashem. That is the role of the priest. They are to do service to Avod V'Shamar, and they are to teach Israel how to approach Hashem, how to live for Him, how to connect, how to represent, all of those things, right? And yet what you have is you have these Sadducees, these rulers of the temple that are dressing up. They look nice. They look the part, overdone. I mean, they look really, quote unquote, blessed, right? And yet behind it, they are buying into this idea that I am the center. I am the one who measures everything. The temple service should be measured after us. The priority of things in holiness and in spirituality is really, we're the arbiters of holiness. We are the arbiters, and we are the ones who define what's right and wrong and what should be done and what shouldn't be done. You see that shift? It's no longer Hashem and the Torah that is the standard. It becomes their own way. And it's tough. But hey, this is not something that is new. This is not something that's new to us, rather. I don't want to get into a mudslinging thing, and I don't want to call anybody out by name, even though I might slip up and do it anyway. But no, I don't think I'll have to. But when I think Sadducees, and maybe some of you are thinking this already, and I don't even have to say it, but I'm going to. When I think Sadducee, I think modern-day televangelists. Now, I'm not saying that every preacher on TV is, you know, crooked and, you know, greasy or whatever. I'm not saying that. First of all, it's not my I don't have the ability to cast that judgment, and I wouldn't want to do that anyway. And with the advent of YouTube now and, you know, streaming and all this different stuff, hey, we're online every week, and so the same could be leveled back at me. So I understand. But we know, you know, when you turn on one of those channels and there's somebody in a, you know, all dressed to the hilt, made up, and you know when they're genuine, and you know when they're just sleazy. You know when you get that ugh vibe, right? That like, don't touch me kind of vibe. You know. So this whole thing about, you know, they wear all these evangelists, you know, televangelists and these TV preachers a lot of times and local preachers, whatever. They wear their Christianity really well. Oh, it's just, they look so blessed and so whatever and blah, blah, blah. But in the back, you get that, ugh, your discernment kicks in and you know that there's something not right there. So this is not something that's new to us, and it's something that we have to guard against and protect ourselves against, and then to make sure that we're not following anybody like that, because the stuff may look good, but the essence leads to a place of destruction. It leads to a place of absolute abomination. So one more point I want to make on this, and we're going to wrap up this episode talking a little bit about the Herodians and we'll kind of touch base on them before we end this episode. But so the other point I want to make is, where is the one place where Israel was commanded, the only place that they could draw near to Hashem as ritual worship? It is Beit HaMikdash, right? It's the temple. It's the house in Jerusalem, right? The place where he will put his name forever, in Yerushalayim. Now, can you imagine, in your, you know, living in Jerusalem, can you imagine being just a young 20s Israelite that your parents came back, you know, after the exile, you're excited, you're studying Torah, maybe you're coming, you came through a few of the phases of school, and maybe you didn't make it through all of them, you didn't attach yourself to a rabbi, but you love Hashem, and you're in your early 20s, you're looking for a wife, and you have a fire for God and for his word and for being a kingdom representative. And the one place that he has commanded you to go and make offerings and to fellowship with him and with other people is at a place that is absolutely corrupt. Imagine you are an elderly, a grandfather, grandmother. Maybe you remember being taken into exile as a tiny child, or maybe your grandparents, maybe you remember stories of being taken into exile, and you're so grateful that those in your before you, the generations before you, decided to come back and resettle the land, decided to come back with Nehemiah or with Ezra, and decided to come back and restore the temple and restore the land, and they've planted vineyards, and they've done all the things that prophecy said that they were to do, and you're so thankful that in your old age you get to live in the land and enjoy this beautiful place where Hashem has given your ancestors before you. And there's one place that God commanded you that when you draw near to him, you must do it seven times a year, three times for the Shalosh Regalim, and you have to pilgrimage feast, and you have to go to the temple. And yet it's corrupt. It's corrupt, and you know it. And so what do you do? What do you do as an Israelite whose heart is right towards God? What do you do as a first century Jew or Benjamite or Simeonite or whatever? What do you do? Do you disobey God and not go? Or do you go and you just trust that God's going to work it out. You know, if in our communities, we're dealing with, of course, COVID-19 and coronavirus. And listen, we're not going to get to the Herodians today because I just want to say this. There's a lot of conspiracies going around. And I know that in every crisis, there's a political statement out there that says, you know, never waste a crisis. I know that with every crisis, there are nefarious actors who are going to take advantage of it, and they are going to use it to build empire. We've talked about empire and shalom. Listen, folks, our politicians, I don't care if you vote Republican or Democrat or independent or libertarian. It doesn't matter. Our political leaders, for the vast majority, are empire. They are leaders of empire. They're not leaders of shalom. And so your political bent really doesn't affect me as much as if you put your faith and trust in the political system, that it is the salvation, it is the euangelion of our day. And it is not. Let's just say I'm not a conspiracy person at all. I know that there are nefarious things that go on, but I don't lay awake at night trying to connect the dots. Maybe I should. But let's just say if you live in a small rural community, let's say there's 8,000, 10,000, 15,000 in your community. And let's say because of coronavirus, because of COVID, because of all the other stuff that's going on, your county or your city council says, look, we don't want to shut down religion. We don't want to shut down churches. So we're going to have one church. One community church that everybody can, that way we can monitor who's going, we can track how many people, we can make sure that social distancing is happening and blah, 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 and all the stuff. So let's say that's it. But let's say it's a pastor who you don't agree with. Let's say it's a pastor who you know is maybe even a little crooked. Who do you think is going to get that job of pastorate? Do you think it's going to be the most anointed person? Nah. It's going to be one of those seven families, right, of the Sadducees. Now, here's one thing I didn't tell you about the Sadducees is that Herod basically, he auctioned off the high priesthood to one of those seven families. Caiaphas is the, I think, great-grandson of one of those seven families who won the high priesthood. And I can't remember the family name that it was right now. Forgive me. I'll remember it for next week. But the family that won basically Herod's auctioning of the high priesthood, Herod said that, you know, the high priesthood would never depart from the house of Annas. Annas, that's who it is. We hear about Annas in the New Testament. That the priesthood would never depart from the house of Annas. Now, let's say you go back to our small town scenario. Who in the world is going to be pastoring the one church in your community? Is it going to be the most called, the most anointed, the most sincere man or woman of God? I don't know about your small town, but that's not how the small towns that I grew up in work. It's going to be whoever's the good old boy club, whoever's the schmoozer, whoever's involved in the politics, right? Corruption, infidelity to the covenant, perspectives and attitudes and nefarious intentions. Do you go or do you not? I can't imagine what it was like for these sincere Israelites under Sadducean rule. Just absolutely terrifying and horrible to think of what they had to deal with. So listen, next week, we didn't get to Herodians this week, but next week we're going to get to Herodians. It's going to be a little bit shorter, so we may cover two groups next week, Herodians and possibly Zealots or Essenes. I'm not sure. We'll figure it out. And so make sure to join us next week for another episode of Image Bearers Radio. Until then, Shavua Tov, Shabbat Shalom. Have a great week. We love you, and we will talk to you again next week.